Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO. Representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Double play of sweeping criminal justice measures advances in the Florida legislature.
Like you guys know around here, everything's being negotiated right now.
Also tonight, a measure to expand access to long-acting reversible contraceptives is moving forward, but not without criticism.
This could be viewed as product marketing or promotion of these devices.
We'll also stop by a Capitol rally in support of STEM education and meet a writer who literally wrote the book on the complex and far-flung ecology of the Gulf of Mexico. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's day two of week number seven in the 2019 Florida lawmaking session, and this is Capitol Report. Two large criminal justice reform bills are moving through the Florida legislature. Ryan Daly reports backers of the similar bills in both chambers are going through negotiations down the stretch to position a final measure for passage.
That is one of the boldest criminal justice reform bills that has ever been seen in the state of Florida.
Senator Jeff Brandis backs the Senate's version of the bill dubbed Florida's First Step Act. In the past few days, he's filed an amendment that would modify the state's truth in sentencing law, reducing a requirement that the incarcerated serve 85% of their sentence to 65%. That allows for inmates to accrue more gain time or time knocked off of a sentence as a reward for good behavior.
The vote was unanimous to support the Florida First Step Act as amended.
The bill has other changes that have been heralded by reform advocates. It increases the threshold warranting a felony theft offense from $300 to $750. It also eases the process for the formerly incarcerated to get required professional licensing for certain jobs after serving their time. With the new additions, Brandis feels the bill, true to its name, provides a comprehensive first step to true reform.
That includes provisions like allowing for 65% gain time for nonviolent offenders, that allows for retroactivity of provisions that the legislature in 2014 and 2016 made to reduce the mandatory minimums on certain crimes, that allows for the legislature to put our focus on diversion, to put our focus on helping people transition back into society.
Brandis is a frequent critic of mandatory minimum sentencing. His bill allows for more lenient sentencing for certain drug trafficking cases, those in which the perpetrator didn't use a gun or other violence and has not been convicted of a previous violent crime. The House's omnibus criminal justice reform bill looks to accomplish many of the same reforms as the Senate's, but Brandis says there are differences.
Well, obviously the House has their one, and we allow for more discretion for judges. So I think there's a couple different ways we can look at mandatory minimums. They get rid of one specific mandatory minimum. We're trying to take the broader view of allowing downward departure for certain mandatory minimums in the state.
One key difference is the House doesn't include a provision in its bill concerning the truth in sentencing law. The omnibus bill is backed by Republican Representative Paul Renner. Renner's colleague, Representative Byron Donalds, spoke about the House measure alongside Brandis at a press conference Tuesday. He says he's open to the idea of adopting adopting some of the Senate language as details are still being hammered out.
I think it's something that I'm open to. I don't want to speak for all my colleagues in the House. Like you guys know around here, everything's being negotiated right now.
Audrey Jennings Hudgens, whose son was given a mandatory minimum life sentence, gave public testimony at the House Appropriations Committee meeting Tuesday as the measure passed. She says she hopes the House will move more toward the Senate with some of the bill's provisions.
I hope the House Appropriations Committee passes House Bill 7125 out of committee and is ready to adopt some of the amendments that will come out of the Senate, such as changing the 85% rule to 65%, so people can actually use the gain time they earn.
Not everyone is on board with the idea of additional gain time. The Florida Sheriff's Association responded to Brandis's amendment with opposition. In a statement Tuesday, FSA President and Columbia County Sheriff Mark Hunter writes, quote, "This bill allows criminals to escape the jail time that a judge determined to be the punishment that fits the crime. Truth in sentencing is important." I'm Ryan Daly.
Women should have better access to long-acting contraceptives. That's according to Boynton Beach Democratic Senator Lori Berman, who's sponsoring a bill moving through the Florida legislature. Regan McCarthy has more.
Research published by the New England Journal of Medicine shows in 2008, 51% of pregnancies in the United States were unintended. And that number is especially concerning when it comes to teens who tend to use less reliable birth control methods. Officials say widespread access to long-lasting reversible birth control like IUDs can help address that. Boynton Beach Democratic Senator Lori Berman has a bill she hopes will help pave the way.
This bill requires the Department of Health to start a countywide pilot program in Duval, Hillsborough, and Palm Beach to expand access to long-acting reversible contraceptives.
Under the program, local departments of health would include the contraceptive devices as part of the family planning services already offered. Berman says the program could create a framework for expansion across the state of Florida.
There will be a report issued at the end, and we will be able to use that for best practices for everywhere in the state.
But Diane Gowski, a doctor working with the Florida Guilds of Catholic Medical Associations, has some concerns.
This could be viewed as product marketing or promotion of these devices.
Gowski says there are two types of long-acting reversible birth control. Some are made of copper, others release hormones. Depending on the type, they're either intrauterine or implanted in a woman's arm.
The problem with this is, you know, they all have side effects and complications. And without mentioning any specific product names, there was an old one that used to be implanted in the arm many years ago, and there was a big class action lawsuit, and I believe it's off the market. So these are relatively newer. I don't think they've been vetted out, but they do have side effects and complications, such as one product, it's about a 25 to 30% prolonged or increased bleeding, which is the most frequent cause of discontinuation.
A report from the Senate Health and Human Services Appropriations Committee says the devices are associated with few side effects. It also says the practice is in the same range of effectiveness for preventing unintentional pregnancy as sterilization. Berman's bill includes a stipulation that it will only take effect if the state appropriates $100,000 to operate the pilot. While the Senate measure has accelerated in the last 2 weeks, leaving it with just one committee left to go, a similar measure in the House has not yet been heard. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a bill that raises the minimum age to purchase tobacco to 21 passed the House Appropriations Committee today, but opponents say the portion including vaping should be taken out.
Vapor is not tobacco. So grouping us together, it doesn't make any sense, and I'm confused. There needs to be a separation.
Even free market advocates now agree something needs to be done about climate change, just so long as that something isn't done in a courtroom.
It's a federal issue. It's something that we need to deal with internationally. It's not something that's for the courts and especially for state courts.
Young fans of science, technology, engineering, and math education show off their formidable knowledge at the Capitol.
I'm able to understand on like the most specific or most basic level possible what exactly I'm witnessing happening around me.
And we'll hear from a renowned writer who insists it's often those most dependent on the Gulf of Mexico who have posed the biggest threat to its survival.
Every municipality in the Gulf was dumping raw sewage into the waters that were the basis of their tourist trade.
Support for Capital Report is provided by the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
According to a study by the Institute of Medicine published in 2015, paid for by the United States Food and Drug Administration, raising the minimum age to purchase tobacco to 21 would reduce the number of lung cancer-related deaths by 50,000. As Blaise Ganey reports, the Florida legislature is now trying to raise the minimum age with hopes of seeing those results.
Tuesday, the Florida House Appropriations Committee passed a bill that would raise the age requirement for purchasing tobacco, nicotine products, and nicotine dispensing devices from 18 to 21. The hope is to keep tobacco out of the hands of minors. But stores that sell the products say the bill won't stop the problem. Matthew Connor, the owner of 7 retail vape shops in Florida, is one of them.
The main reason is the federal government and the media itself has labeled vaping an epidemic. I'm here to tell all of you today there is an epidemic, but it's not on vaping itself. The epidemic is in all the retailers and the adults out there providing these tobacco products to underage individuals.
Others who came up said they started smoking at a young age, and it wasn't from the black market, but from a convenience store.
I started smoking when I was 15, and I did not get these cigarettes from my friends or family. I would walk to a convenience store down the street from my high school and buy a pack for $9. $4 for cigarettes, the rest was for the clerk to pocket. This wasn't uncommon.
That's Kelsey Orlando, a 22-year-old nursing student from Pinellas County. She says it wasn't until she turned 18 that she stopped smoking by using a vaping device.
I tried to stop before I was 18, but I got carded at the vape shop.
And others who testified, like Zach Goodson, a vape retail salesman, said they used the vaping device to stop also.
So I started smoking at 14. Not once was I worried about any existing T18 provisions. I knew the guy at my gas station. I got my 2 packs of Newports. I got my can of snus. I didn't come to that realization that I needed to quit, that I needed to find a healthier alternative until a week after I turned 18. My first time buying a vapor device, I was carded. I was questioned a little bit. And then at the end, I was wished happy birthday, and I got my hands on a healthier alternative.
Matthew Connor, the vape shop owner, says the solution is to up the ante on the current laws.
There is a solution. The solution is we need to enforce the T18 law better, and the ones that are out there breaking this law and providing these products to the underage individuals out there, there needs to be a harsher consequence.
But Palm Bay Republican Representative Randy Fine says increasing the age to 21 not only will help reduce the number of deaths related to smoking, but also save the state billions of dollars in health care.
We're spending more than $4 billion a year of taxpayer money here in Florida to deal with problems that are caused from smoking. My budget's $8 billion. So half as much as we spend on higher education, we're spending taxpayer money treating smoking.
But Connor, the vape shop owner, believes this will only entice people to go to the black market to find tobacco.
You're going to create a black market. There's already 18 and 19 and 20-year-olds out there smoking combustible tobacco products or using vaping devices. You're going to make them break the law. You're creating them a criminal of something they bought yesterday with a snap of a finger.
Michael Bowling Jr. says vaping shouldn't be included. He says the device is mostly used to wean tobacco users off of their nicotine addiction.
Vapor is not tobacco. So grouping us together, it doesn't make any sense, and I'm confused. There needs to be a separation.
Something else that isn't tobacco is also in the bill, medical marijuana. The bill would increase the age limit for smoking medical marijuana to 21. Orlando Democratic Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith disagrees with the move.
I don't think that these issues need to be intertwined. We're talking about raising the age to smoke tobacco, which has no health benefit whatsoever, with a medicine, which is smokable medical cannabis. The American Cancer Society was here, and they told us, as well as many other organizations that are experts, will say that there is no direct link between smokable cannabis and lung cancer.
The bill does, however, let one select group of 18 to 20-year-olds smoke. Bill sponsor and Miami Democratic Representative Nicholas Duran explains.
If you are going to be taking bullets and fighting for the country, if you need a cigarette to cool down, who am I to tell you while you're fighting and serving for this country that you can't use that cigarette or have a cigarette?
Beverly Hills Republican Representative Ralph Masullo questioned if the military allows the same for other drugs that are known to have calming effects.
Do you know if before they go into battle, if military personnel are allowed to have a drink of alcohol or a type of drug that might also calm them down?
You recognize?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do not believe so, and that is a very good point.
The bill passed the committee, but many members said they would like to see changes made before they approve it in the full chamber. I'm Blaze Ganey.
Phil Goldberg is a managing partner with the Washington, D.C.-based firm of Shook, Hardy & Bacon. His specialty is litigation related to climate change.
There has been litigation dealing with climate change going back 15 years. And the first time around went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, no, climate change is something that we need to address in the policy levels, in the Congress, in the agencies. It's a federal issue. It's something that we need to deal with internationally. It's not something that's for the courts, and especially for state courts.
Goldberg points out that the U.S. Supreme Court ruling was authored by the justice widely considered to be the court's most liberal.
Justice Ginsburg actually wrote the opinion and said we shouldn't be setting up our judges to be super EPAs. And that litigation went away. We're now in the next round of climate change lawsuits where the people bring in this litigation, try to figure out, okay, well, how do we try to make it so that we can get around what Ginsburg said and what the court said?
A challenge for the litigants, says Goldberg, is that they targeted electric utilities and occasionally the manufacturers that consume large amounts of their power as the prime contributors to climate change.
Because this is such a large societal problem, you can't put blame on any one sector of the economy, any manufacturers, any users. This is something we all need to deal with together, and we need to do it in a smart and thoughtful way.
Which brings us to Florida. Bob McClure is the executive director of the pro-free market James Madison Institute, headquartered a few blocks from the state capitol. He's also watched with alarm as various jurisdictions elsewhere have filed these kinds of lawsuits.
Colorado, Rhode Island, and other states have gone to court to look for money from energy companies who they allege, wrongly I would might add, are responsible for the rise in sea levels, wildfires associated with climate change, et cetera, et cetera.
McClure adding Florida is not immune.
It has reared its head in places like Fort Lauderdale here in the state of Florida because climate change, sea level rise, these are serious issues that warrant serious discussions. And so the state of Florida is uniquely impacted by climate change and rises in sea levels. But suing manufacturers or suing energy companies to recoup some number of dollars because of climate change, the courts have just said this is not our role.
Attorney Goldberg worries that the federal judicial bulwark against such suits might fail at some point.
Then states should step in and say if whether or not they want their towns and their counties bringing this kind of litigation, because it affects everybody in the state, even though it may be one town that's bringing the litigation.
Although JMI's Bob McClure doesn't think the time for that has arrived, at least not in Florida.
I don't think there needs to be kind of a quick reaction by anybody to do anything legislatively, but I do think there needs to be some level of tort reform in general. But specific as it relates to these kinds of lawsuits, I think there's a broader discussion about tort reform that certainly needs to happen.
As well as a larger discussion of the whole issue of climate change, just so long as that discussion isn't in a courtroom.
These court cases are not about whether climate change is actually happening or not, how much, how fast, and what the root cause is. That's not what this is about. Everybody knows there is climate change. There are decisions to be made when it comes to that, but not in the court.
Meanwhile, the only active climate change lawsuit in Florida was filed by a group of 8 young Floridians last year. Its defendants, instead of utilities or private manufacturers, are state government officials. Florida's capital was the site of STEM Day today. Morgan Martin reports the event was meant to interest more young people in science, technology, engineering, and math careers.
During STEM Day at Florida State Capitol, students are exploring STEM careers through hands-on programs. Orlando Science Center Director of Educational Operations, Scott Hallpern, says STEM can help students experience their own superpower by learning how humans can conduct electricity through an energy stick demonstration.
This is an energy stick, and it just works with, it has just a little battery in it, and it's a basic conductivity, so creating a circuit. A circuit has a ground and it has a positive, and it always creates a circle. So if I touch the metal end with one finger and I touch the metal end with another, it creates that noise and it lights up.
Orlando Center's Vice President of Marketing, Jeff Stanford, says science centers and museums around the state are working together to fill the pipeline for tomorrow's tech jobs today.
Our young people need to have these skills to be successful. Beyond that, our corporations, people like Motorola and Harris and big corporations like Lockheed Martin and Siemens and Boeing, they need engineers desperately. And the next batch of engineers is going to come from today's youth. And if they're not excited about these concepts now, they're not going to stay excited, engaged, encouraged to go on and get these degrees.
Harrison Knight, a student at Vanguard High School in Ocala, Florida, says he enjoys knowing how things work. But the key to loving STEM is having a good science teacher.
Through science, whether it be biology, chemistry, physics, all of these different fields, I'm able to understand on like the most specific or most basic level possible what exactly I'm witnessing happening around me.
To continue the push for a STEM-educated workforce, Tech Day is scheduled at Florida State Capitol Thursday. I'm Morgan Martin.
Gina Jordan tells us the pace of activity is starting to ramp up at the Capitol.
Here's a look at what's happening tomorrow at the Capitol. The House will hold a floor session. Members will consider an ethics reform package for public service officers and employees, and a proposal that would require parental consent before minors could have abortions. Another bill up for consideration could lead to needle and syringe exchange programs in various parts of the state. The Senate has already passed its version of the bill as lawmakers look to curb the spread of diseases by intravenous drug users. The Senate Rules Committee will take up numerous bills, including a potential revamp of the insurance practice known as assignment of benefits and a proposal to prevent sanctuary cities in Florida. The Senate is also scheduled to hold a floor session. The chamber could approve a bill that would lead to the tourism marketing agency Visit Florida operating for at least the next 8 years. The agency has been criticized by House leaders and will be eliminated October 1st unless lawmakers reauthorize it. That's some of what's coming up in the Florida legislature. I'm Gina Jordan.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, the News Service of Florida is reporting that Governor Ron DeSantis says he'll raise Cain if national drilling plans advance that include Florida waters, particularly in the Gulf of Mexico. The story broke just as a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian came to Tallahassee to discuss his book on the world's 10th largest body of water. Margie Menzel reports.
Jack Davis, professor of environmental history at the University of Florida, won the 2018 Pulitzer Prize for History for his book, The Gulf, The Making of an American Sea. On Sunday, he spoke at the Word of South Literary and Music Festival, where he was introduced by Diane Roberts, herself a distinguished environmental writer.
This state is a vexed and magical place all at once, and it's complex how we got to that place. But how we got there has so much to do with our being wet, basically. We're half water.
And Davis writes about both the magic and the vexation. He grew up on the Gulf of Mexico, which his book traces from its formation to present time. He says he wrote it for a general, not an academic audience, because he wanted readers to understand how they're connected to the Gulf.
The Gulf of Mexico is one of the richest estuarine environments in the world. We have a commercial fishery. The U.S. Gulf Coast commercial fishery is more productive than the entire East Coast fishery, except when there's an oil spill, of course.
80% of domestic shrimp come from the Gulf, he said, and 40% of domestic oysters. It's also the most popular saltwater fishing spot in the country, which has drawn many people, including the painter Winslow Homer. Davis read from his book about Homer's trip to the Gulf in 1904.
Wherever Homer drifted with bait and tackle, the water beneath his rowing skiff was clear, several feet to a grassy bottom, flush with crabs, mollusks, and a thousand living things unseen. Among the most scintillating of sights were fish in schools, as long as freight trains, running with the invisible Gulf tide. Their imposing numbers invited eagles and ospreys that circled overhead.
Lyrical and scientific, the book ranges from tales of the Gulf's heroes to the loss of its shorelines and living creatures. Many parts are still as pristine as when Homer was here, Davis said. But by the late 1960s, the bays and bayous were on the verge of ecological collapse.
Every municipality on the Gulf was dumping raw sewage into the waters that were the basis of their tourist trade. But it wasn't just the Gulfside municipalities, it was faraway places up those rivers and other parts of the United States. Whatever they put in the rivers, it ends up in the bay.
Now people want to know, Davis said, whether there's hope for the Gulf. He says there is, crediting the Clean Water Act of 1972 and the efforts of universities, nonprofits, conservation groups, and private landowners.
One of the big trends now, which is an extremely important one, is restoring the living shoreline, seagrass beds, those oyster bars, mangrove forests where they can grow, and coastal marshes. They are our best defense against sea level rise and intense seas.
Davis called restoration of the living shoreline a win-win-win. They're also the nurseries for marine life, he said, and they absorb carbon from the air and water. Professor Davis is also the author of the award-winning In Everglades Providence, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, and the American Environmental Century. I'm Margie Menzel.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. Thanks also to Morgan Martin and Margie Menzel. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again every weeknight throughout the Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care, on the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org.